Welcome back to Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Judy Nathans.
And I'm Robert Winters. And let's not talk more about elections.
No voting.
Proportional representation.
Right. All right. Let's go to the nitty-gritty.
Right.
What happened?
So there was some things that happened up at City Hall last night. I wasn't up there, but I tuned in.
Me too.
And, kind of took track. And, of course, I always look at things in advance just to kind of handicap the race and sort of know what's coming up.
Yes.
One thing that I thought they might have taken up last night, but they did not take up, was the cannabis issue.
Yeah. Reefer madness.
Reefer madness.
On your post.
So the so they have some of the zoning is all in place, but the thing is there's the one little missing piece is sort of a regulatory piece, and again I'm going to say this in the most minimal way, but it was that they have to make decisions as to how to grant the permitting amongst the so-called social equity versus economic empowerment kind of special cases there. Mm-hmm. If you're kind of a full vertically integrated marijuana production machine, mm-hmm. that you grow it, you move it, you sell it,
you've got lots
smoke
of
it, you
stuff,
eat it, you whatever.
You've got
but
a lot of financial backing.
Yeah, so those tend to be the high, the big rollers. They have, but the thing is that there are these provisions under the state law for social equity and economic empowerment. Now, what those exactly mean? Well, all right, you can
but
probably figure
it out.
But it's
not giving them money, though, is it?
No, it's not giving them money. But
it's
the thing
giving
is
them a chance to compete, but if they don't
but they
have
don't
the
need
money,
to have the whole vertical integration. They don't need to generate their own product.
No, but they still need to get a business plan and have money, and that's very hard to do.
And that's right. So, but the thing is, you don't need even a fraction of what it takes to be one of the mainstream ones. Now, certain provisions in the zoning law, like you can't have the regular ones more than 1,800 feet close to each other, or less than 1,800 feet, but that doesn't apply apparently to the social equity. It sort of doesn't make sense
because it could be closer to a school.
Yeah. So the thing is that there's all this sort of carving out of exceptions in order to give it a competitive advantage. But they didn't vote it, right? But it'll probably come up in another week or two.
Well, there's only a few meetings left in June.
Right. Well, the thing is, it's a regulation. But the thing is that there are these businesses are already kind of trying to get in a meeting with community groups and whatever.
Oh, there's all these community
meetings.
So
you can't kind of hold off forever on the regulation. So it's coming quick, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is that, I mean, you know, with the Central Square Advisory Committee, we had one social equity applicant and one economic empowerment applicant, both trying to open up within 100 or 200 feet of a one that's already opening up in Central Square, right? And it was a kind of a curious process where it's almost like their applicants are sort of trying to show how connected they are, you know, so they have former elected officials are serving as their legal counsel. They're saying how connected they are to the community, whatever. It's a little like political patronage without being political patronage.
So they don't have to prove that they can financially do it?
I think they do have to make that case before they get the permit.
I would hope so. Could fail and then you've gone through all
right, that. Right, that's true. But the thing is that it's not nearly as strong a financial commitment necessary as it would be for the others. So how is it going to shake out? I don't know. But, you know, I was curiously looking at the committee reports from the city council where they were actually arguing that, well, should we be giving an advantage to the social equity applicants or the economic empowerment applicants?
I don't know. Actually, I don't even know what the difference in those terms are. Is social equity like women, men?
I think people who have somehow sort of got a raw deal under the war on drugs, you know, so actually having a conviction can actually give you an advantage under those criteria.
How many of those people are actually interested in opening a...
It doesn't
odd.
Need to be many, you know.
Economic empowerment? Would that be more on that?
It could be that, or it could be ones where they're actually going to hire a lot of local people, give jobs locally, whatever. I mean, I'll be honest with you, in the great grand scheme of sort of handing out preferential treatment, I kind of go more with the economic empowerment because if you're going to be providing jobs to
holistic.
Local people, that just makes a lot more sense. It's not a matter of trying to, you know, right the wrongs of the past. It just says, we're here and now, what's best, right?
Right.
So anyway, the council's got to make some decisions on this.
This whole thing makes me absolutely nuts. I voted against it. There's too many of, I'm too much for this world at this point.
It was too much for
me. Between the self-driving cars and cannabis and everything. I
find it interesting. I think when the book is written about the 2018-2019 Cambridge City Council, what it'll be remembered for. Yeah, when marijuana is actually going to be probably one of them, the main things.
And bikes and
social housing, I guess.
But you stopped with the social housing.
Well, I mean, that's what it is.
I don't think so.
Right?
That's just a definition.
That's just a definition. Now, there are other things that were on the council that were not really matters to vote, which I did find kind of interesting. One was there was a small, I think it was like a $2,000 expenditure to finish out a project called Mapping Feminist Cambridge.
Oh, yeah. I saw that, yeah.
And I looked at that and I said, I like stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, because the thing is, what you're doing is you're getting historical stuff, largely 20th century historical stuff, and sort of putting it out there for people to consume. And, you know, there's been far too little history of Cambridge in the 20th century put out there. And a big piece of that history includes things like women's movement things, countercultural matters.
Like mapping it as permanent sites.
Yeah. So sometimes that just becomes sort of markers on the streets. But sometimes it's basically, you know, it can be something as like they have a website. I think at the Women's Commission has a website that they put together that has, it's sort of like a gallery of significant women over the last few centuries in Cambridge.
Oh, yeah.
Some of whom we know, you know. It's very contemporary.
Still living. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very much. Mm-hmm. And I love that type of stuff. And it reminded me when I saw the expenditure that I think it was two summers ago, I actually went on one of these ones with a Women's Commission group. Mm-hmm. I think it was that. They were at least co-sponsors of it. And it was basically doing a walking tour. And I was pleased when I went looking around about this a couple of days ago. They actually have four different PDFs that you can download
for different walks.
Yeah, it's sort of on a you know, feminist history.
Oh, so all of these are through the Women's. That wasn't clear on what.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's one in Area 4, Cambridgeport, Riverside, and Cambridgeport, and in Mid Cambridge, right. So I don't know what the expenditure is going to be.
Here's just a sample. You can show this.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is Cambridgeport.
It just gives you some route maps.
Oh, look at that. You can go 2 miles.
And if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see it actually gives you some, you know, not only just the how you go, but also, let's go down a little further. I think it actually gives you some of the narrative, or does it? Maybe not in this one.
So
then it actually gives you the names and gives you some background.
First female put. This is wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's really great.
I didn't even know about this, and I was on the Women's Commission.
Yeah, so the thing is, when I see stuff like this on a Cambridge City Council thing, I say, this needs to be highlighted.
And 2,000, that's nothing.
It's just not for this specifically. It's for something called, the title was Mapping Feminist Cambridge.
Yeah.
You know, there's actually places like Inman Square was sort of a hotbed for a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these buildings are sort of gone now. But,
some
of them are still around.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, you can do that. And it reminded me, there was a fellow, it's actually coming up soon, there, a fellow named Tim Devon of Somerville. I think he works in the library at Somerville.
Hmm.
He's put together, I got three booklets about called Mapping Utopia, which was about these countercultural movements in Boston, Cambridge, and elsewhere. Mm. And I've gone on at least two of his walking tours.
At least two of these walking tours.
And they were incredibly informative.
Why is he calling it utopia? Curious.
I think it was these sort of utopian ideals, you know, sort of the counterculture.
Wow.
They said, you know, we're going to reinvent the world. And they were all very, very forward-looking. You know, and, you know, there are some of the characters who were really, really big on that are now the characters you'll just see sitting in a coffee shop as an old guy now.
So he has one coming up on July 13th?
July 13th, okay. Yeah. So this one's actually, we want like, I think, $5 because they had too many people, I think, on at least one of these. So they want to kind of manage it a little bit better.
Yeah.
But they're really worth it. I mean, I enjoyed them a lot.
Mm.
You know, I had this great photo of, there was on Prospect Street, there was a place called the Trout Fishing in America School.
Yeah, I see you mentioned that.
And, you know, I've had the picture around for a long time. And And I didn't really know a lot about it. It was really for some kids who weren't making it in the traditional high school, and it was kind of an alternative school for them.
But in the middle of Cambridge trout fishing? I mean, you have to go to trout fishing to get...
No, Trout Fishing America is a book by Richard Brautigan.
Oh, of course.
And the picture actually has Richard Brautigan in Cambridge visiting at the Trout Fishing America school. Oh, you're right.
It's not meaning what it is. Okay.
Right. And they actually moved, after they left the building on Prospect Street, they actually went in on Broadway, very close to where I live, in the same building where the Broadway Bicycle School then followed it. So in a way, you would argue that the Broadway Bicycle School is kind of a continuation of the idea, at least.
That was a novel, wasn't it?
Was
it a novel?
I guess you could call it a novel, right?
Okay.
Sort of a strange book at the time, but it was very sort of part of the counterculture. Anyway, so Tim Devon does these wonderful tours, and at the one we did, we actually had somebody who ran the photography stuff for Trout Fishing America School.
Hmm.
I think it's a guy named Greg Hill. So I met him, and then he provided a bunch of other photos I had never seen.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah, and it was...
He's a librarian, I think. Maybe.
Right, so anyway, it was great. And so, you know, whenever I see things like that, just like whenever I see the Cambridge...
You know where you'll be July 13th then.
I'm pretty sure. I think I can spring for the $5.
Yeah,
sure.
I think you can.
Yeah, yeah. You know. But anyway, these are good things. The Cambridge Historical Commission continues to put out oral histories.
Mm.
This is really the good stuff. This is like the extras of life in Cambridge that I think more people should know about.
There's lots of walks that they sponsor. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do.
It's so much more fun when you do a walking tour with either Charlie Sullivan from the Cambridge Historical Commission or others. When there are people who are actually part of some of the history that you're actually walking in. It's just great. And, you know, this is the time of year when you would want to have these because the weather's good and, you know, and it's just it's a really great thing. So anyway, look for it. I think it's a great thing. So one other thing I'll mention briefly is there was often there were resolutions noting people who passed away or retirements or whatever.
Yeah.
So I want to make a special note here for Mark McCabe. Mark McCabe, sort of the head of the Cambridge Animal Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows Mark wearing his kind of policeman suit.
Yeah.
But he's the dog officer, essentially, the animal control officer for the city. And since they've been right down the street from me is where the Animal Commission has been located, I have been running into Mark and talking with Mark for as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he's retiring, I think, this month, probably in another week or so. So, you know, fare thee well, Mark McCabe.
Very wonderful guy.
Yeah.
I met him when I was doing something with CCTV on Fort Washington and dog parks.
Yeah.
He was very helpful.
He's one of the most helpful people in the city.
He might have been in it. I forget.
Yeah. Honestly, the Animal Commission has been some of the most helpful people I've met in the city. They were actually giving one of the Outstanding Employee Awards to one person from the Animal Commission a few weeks ago. And when she was up there, I was saying, like, oh, I remember her. We went up the ladder up on my roof when there was a raccoon up there. Or a cat whatever.
They caught a raccoon in a construction thing that was, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
They'll do those things.
Oh, yeah.
Anytime.
Definitely.
You call them anytime, too.
I know. Well, not overnight. Oh. You can leave a message, but then
well,
usually...
Well, what do you do if there's something's happening overnight?
They call the cops, I think, at that point.
Okay.
You know, if it's really an emergency or something like that. There's one other kind of curious thing. I didn't read it super carefully, but there's language for, or at least for a starting point for a home rule petition having to do with these transportation network companies, TNCs.
And that was charter-righted because charter-righted, but also Craig Kelly wasn't there.
Right. Okay, so it's interesting because if you look at it, it's...
Is that the one he tried to write? Am I wrong about that?
Not sure. Not sure. But, you know, the thing is, a lot of things that they pass, they don't discuss. They just sort of wave them through. But
no, this was pulled.
Specifically,
yeah.
Right. So the idea there is that... You know, and it's interesting because, you know, you have to read between the lines sometimes.
No, you're right. It was number 5,
Right? So there's... you know, there was some city council orders of people who were bothered by the fact that Uber and Lyft drivers would block bike lanes and whatever. But, you know, and okay, great. So if you want to, like, pass some regulations to somehow kind of curtail Uber and Lyft because they're not being good neighbors, okay, great. But meanwhile, who's the one who provided the language, but it was the Cambridge, the local taxi medallion owners who basically see them as competition. So when I see something like that, I say, okay, so they trying to propose some home rule legislation here in order to ensure person, you know, safety of cyclists, et cetera, et cetera. Or are they basically sort of shilling for the medallion owners?
They're shilling for them, but they're trying to, I guess, reach out. It, you're right. It was not pulled, but it was just it was charter righted before they even.
I'll be the first one to say that I think it is not a level playing field. I mean, the thing is that taxi cabs were like this heavily regulated entity for years, and then just because of some quirkiness in the way the laws are written, the Uber and Lyft who are taxis. Let's face it, they're taxis.
Yeah, yeah.
But legally, no. They're just networking and connecting people with cars.
Well, it's like the Airbnbs, are they?
So the thing is, all this disruptive economics is great because I suppose it gives more consumer choice, but it has been pretty disruptive in other ways that have not been always so good.
Well, if you didn't have the medallion issue and the fact that they had to buy thousands, hundreds. I mean, they were counting on them for their retirement. I think that's the same thing with the liquor license, too.
Right, but what happened with some of those is, like, there was one guy, I forget the fellow's name, but in Boston, he owned like 400 medallions. Oftentimes, they put forward this impression that it's a poor immigrant person who has a medallion and they need it to feed their family.
No, but a lot of them, though, bought them through that person. In other words, maybe they were.
The value would, because of Uber and Lyft and these TNCs, the value of a medallion is it's not worthless, but it's
worth $50,000.
Yeah,
they
so people
like $300,000-$400,000.
That's right. People were paying hundreds of thousands of dollars, but it's sort of like liquor. The same dilemma with the liquor licenses in Cambridge.
Right.
So the thing is, when you had all these liquor caps. So then, you know, if you wanted to open up a restaurant, you wanted to have beer and wine, you had to get it from somebody and you paid an exorbitant amount of money. But then they changed the rules down the road. And I'm glad they're changing the rules. But it meant that if you paid a lot of money under the old rules, there's not a great resolution yet. Maybe there will never be a great resolution.
Well, I don't see how there could be, because then you could say the same thing about the taxis, no?
You know, there could be sort of
that was never a state regulated thing, right? The medallions, was that all privately done?
The problem with the medallions as well as the liquor licenses is that it's not like the license commissions set the values. They did initially, and it's relatively modest. But the thing is then when there's a cap on how many are out there, then it's basically you bid on them. And so the thing is
but
the price
is the medallions, though, was there a cap? I mean,
yes.
So the state did have some input into that?
The
city does.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the thing is, they issued only a certain number of licenses. And
I see.
I remember it being controversial when they were going to be issuing another seven licenses.
Yeah.
And then the people who already had licenses, they felt that they were somehow being given away for free.
Well, yeah.
When, you know, why are you doing selling that for a few $1,000 when I paid
$100,000
for mine, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunate because I think there's situations like that.
You know, in my kind of laissez-faire economical worldview, I don't like caps at all. I think what works better is that you have non-transferable licenses and you simply make the case to the local license commission about whether you should have it or not, and it's not transferable, you can't sell it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether the state law is in agreement with that point of view.
Mm.
I think that, you know, it might still be saleable, you know.
Mm.
But I think... I think the idea of turning these things into commodities that can be bought and sold is just a bad, bad road to go down.
Well, that's probably never
going to
happen again.
Probably not. I mean, and if one good thing comes out of all this disruptive economics, maybe it is that we'll never, hopefully never go back to that sort of
rigidity.
But
it seems like we're
trying
to really regulate now Airbnb and all.
Yeah.
In other words, it's kind of, okay, this all happened. Let's now, we got to get
regulation
so we can get the money.
Because
I
own a three-family house,
I got a card
in the mail.
We got one at River Street.
Yeah, I think
it was
citywide.
Citywide.
Because they don't actually know who's actually has Airbnbs going. So
no,
I think
they're just giving you a,
you better register, right? Now,
you need that money for everything.
And I think the registration rates haven't been great.
No,
so the
they're like a third, if
something
if
that. Like that.
Yeah.
And the Airbnb industry isn't being particularly cooperative either, you know. So, you know, but I mean, I'm I'll be the first to admit that I think that just saying, okay, everybody rent any space you have anywhere, anytime, maybe isn't really the best, right? Because things could become a little too chaotic.
Well, no, but I mean, I think Airbnb, if it's done well, not like taking over a whole building where it's...
And that's actually the biggest...
That's what they're
trying
to get at. The
bigger problem, you know. So on the one hand, you've right. got people who are on...
Not mom and pops and not people...
People want to actually, you know, build deed-restricted housing or whatever.
That's and then the problem.
And then meanwhile, at the same time, because they're saying, well, we need more of this housing... Then you're taking housing off the market, the free market, to turn it into essentially short-term hotels.
Well, whatever they are, they're taking like new developments. Okay, let's take these two. Right. That's going to be because we're already managing it, and we're going to use Airbnb. That's
right.
not right.
If you had no regulation at all about this, you could easily have a situation in a place like Cambridge or portions of Boston, where you would see like people going to rent hotels. Where what would happen is instead of renting hotels, you end up with this free-for-all where every house on the block is basically competing for attention to sort of rent rooms because they can make more money by short-term rentals than they can
But a lot of the people that go to a hotel aren't going to go to just somebody's house.
Right.
I mean,
so it's a
whole different kind
it's
of
a different kind of clientele.
Yeah.
Right. But the thing is that I don't know that I would be thrilled if, in fact, most buildings in my neighborhood were, in fact, primarily just short-term rental mini hotels.
No, of course not.
You know? No. I want to have regular neighbors so you get to know.
Right.
Now, do I have a right to want that? I think I'd like to have that right.
Yeah.
So to whatever degree the local government can at least come up with a reasonable regulation, I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
And I think they've tried to do that, and we'll see how it shakes out. I mean, when they passed the Airbnb rules, what is it, a year or two ago? It's been a while since they implemented. I think it might have been just last summer when it went into place, right?
Right.
But, it's not perfected at all.
No.
And it'll be sort of interesting to see where that goes.
It all comes down to enforcement, unless you're going to really knock on doors, which I guess they have. Or somebody on the street complains about those rolling suitcases going back and forth. And, that's all how they find out where places are.
Right.
So. I don't know.
Who knows, right? One other thing we had on the committee report end of things, there was a committee report from the health and environment was on the zero waste master plan.
I went to that hearing.
Right. So who's the chair of that? Was that
it's co-chaired? Is it Devereaux and Zondervan?
Could be that.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think there was another one. It's Carlone and Zondervan for another committee, but I forget which. Right. So I think, you were at the meeting. So
I was
you
at the meeting.
Knew,
I spoke. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know more or less what went down.
Yeah. It was a presentation of the DPW's, it's in the report and it's online, what they're getting for things and what, the new things and the rates of competition.
So, I mean, it's important that people understand that the evolving nature of waste management and recycling.
Right. But also, and a big goal is to reduce our trash putouts and coming up with a proper size bin. And I guess what's been proposed is a 32-gallon up to 48, but I'm going on more go up to 48 because 32 is the size of the little compost bins.
Yeah.
Not the little, the bigger ones. And I think that's too much.
Yeah.
I mean, too little. And most toters, I don't know what you have, but people have 50-gallon, those gray things with the black tops. I see them all over, and those are 50-gallon, which can actually hold 150 pounds. So my big beef was they always use pounds and gallons and interchangeably, and you shouldn't. But we do have to reduce our trash.
That's true.
Right.
That's true.
Why we implemented compost, which is expanding to 13 plus.
Yeah, one of the things that I take special note of is that, since we were on the recycling advisory committee for ages,
decades. Well, you helped start recycling in Cambridge before.
We're
going to have a show on that, by the way.
We'll do that because...
He was asking about history. We've got to finish out history, though. It only went up to 2000.
I have a few little bits and pieces there.
Right.
We do need to round it up. I didn't realize it was 30 years since we actually got this thing going.
I
said, 30 years?
1989.
You're kidding me. Yeah, it was 1989. Yeah. But one of the themes I pressed from 1991 on till I left the Recycling Advisory Committee was... You know, I always I always felt that you shouldn't jump the shark. You know, in other words, don't push too far, too fast ahead of the industry. You kind of push a little ahead, but not too far, you know. And so, because the last thing you want to do is to sort of be kind of this pulling back.
Yeah.
So, like right now, for example, small, it's a small matter really, but like everybody's accustomed to recycling waxed paper cartons, and now you can't do that anymore, right?
And
that's that's small.
People are still putting it in there, but no, it's true. You don't want to take
it away, but
right now it's being veiled and not going anywhere.
So. Right. And you don't want to necessarily be encouraging recycling if the economics just makes it completely crazy too. So,
but it is, stuff is getting recycled. People came up to us at the festival because I was helping there at the booth, and no, it is getting recycled.
Yeah.
There is, and in fact, those hated plastics, the one, they are the second high, they get more for that after cardboard than all the other things. So it's not like we, you know.
Well, one of the things that I do find kind of refreshing is that a lot of this knowledge of the sort of the intricacies of the business is something that only those of us who would go to recycling advisory committees would know. So to whatever degree, for better or worse, a lot of that information is being thrust on the public. I think it's a good thing because it's time to find this out.
Right.
You know, the phrase they've been trying to promote is recycle right, I think, now.
Yeah, recycle smart. Recycle right.
smart.
Yeah.
So in other words,
don't throw in your hoses.
So I think we've achieved the consciousness of recycling. But now it's time to refine that a little bit. And sort of say, let's understand a little bit better. And I hope that in the coming years that American, you know, entrepreneurs will actually create the markets, so we don't have to
That is happening.
Dependent on Chinese
we
markets.
We are waking up to say, well, why did we close all those mills? Why did we do that? And it's starting.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's still going to take a few years, so it's going to be.
Yeah, I always figure it's about a 4 or 5 year minimum before that stuff really happens.
So we've already into year two.
So anyway, it's always things to learn from City Council agendas.
We'll see you next week.
We'll be back on for another exciting adventure of Cambridge Inside Out.
Okay.